All right, what time is 10:15 show roll start?
Oh, it starts right.
Such a stinker. Oh, you think this guy did radio for a living or something?
Hey, everybody, it's Kai Ryssdal. Oh, my goodness.
And I'm Molly Wood. You are listening to Make Me Smart Weekly Edition, a.k.a. The Big Show, where we get to dive into one topic, bring on an expert guest to help us get smarter together. Today, we are going close to home on the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We're going to the bottom. Food. Food. Can you get it? Are you going to be able to get it consistently if shutdowns and illnesses continue to roll on, which I believe they will? What we would like to know today is the deal with the food supply.
You have heard, I'm sure, this week that meat processing plants are shutting down. There was that big one in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, the pork plant there, because workers are testing positive. 300 in that factory, to which I've been, by the way. It's quite a scene there. They're going to have a hard time stocking shelves, is what we are told by the pork producers. Now, yes, that's them talking their book, but you know. Farmers are dumping some of their food. You've heard about milk, right, being disposed of because they don't have supply lines to get it to stores or even to food banks, which serve, of course, the neediest among us.
Right. And then on top of that, we're hearing that trade is shrinking and countries are actually starting to ban exports of medical supplies, but also food. And so what we really want to know here, in a way that does not induce panic, because I think that series of meat stories yesterday caused some panic. And people are seeing inconsistent supply on store shelves, and that is a stressor. And so what we really want to know is, should we worry? So to help us figure out what is going on, should we worry, how much, and in what direction, generally, is our question today. For Millie Munchie, she is an editor for Bloomberg's Agriculture America's team. Millie, thanks for coming on Make Me Smart.
Hey, thank you both. Thanks for having me.
So, Millie, we keep hearing, you know, these two things, right? And seeing, I think, these two things for ourselves. One is that the grocery stores, the shelves are empty in some cases. The other, though, is that there is enough food supply to keep us fed and we should not panic. How do we reconcile these kind of two opposing realities?
Yeah, that's a great question. There is a bit of a contradiction going on. In terms of food supplies, what's in warehouses and inventory? There's plenty of food, especially if you are considering the United States. There's, you know, huge hunks of frozen pork. There's wheels of cheese. There's bags of potatoes, that kind of thing. Warehouses are pretty well stocked in the U.S. What's going on is the supply chain getting that food from warehouses to grocery stores. And there's a number of different choke points in that supply. One of the big things is trucking. That's in the U.S., but all around the world is trucking is a big problem. And that's because, you know, truckers are running into things like when they go to warehouses, there's such a huge amount of demand to get things loaded up that it's taking longer than usual. And then at the same time, when they're making these long haul journeys, they don't have access to a lot of the essential services that they need. If you think about even using a clean bathroom, taking a shower, getting a place to get a hot meal, all those things are really big problems for truckers.
Are these problems for truckers and other choke points in the supply chain, were they pre-existing and they're just being exacerbated and laid bare by this crisis, or are these new problems?
It's a little bit of both going on. In North America, in the last few years, there's been a little bit of trucking shortages. There's been shortages of finding enough people who are laborers to do tasks at farms, farmhands, that kind of thing. Some meat companies have had a hard time filling jobs. So there's a little bit of that pre-existing stuff going down, but there's also a lot of this stuff has been really exacerbated. You know, you mentioned the slaughterhouses that were shut down. Yeah. There was the big one in South Dakota, and there was also a big one in Colorado. And that is really because of the virus. You know, workers are getting sick. When you go into a slaughterhouse, people are working like elbow to elbow all down the line, right in close proximity to each other. Once one kind of outbreak starts, it's hard to keep it contained. That's why we're seeing some of these shutdowns.
Yeah.
I know that one of the problems is that before the pandemic, most of us, or a lot of us, consume more of our food outside the house, in restaurants. I keep wondering, like, when I hear these stories about the food being wasted at farms, couldn't the wholesalers just keep selling to the restaurants and the restaurants just convert to essentially grocery stores?
You know, it's funny. Some restaurants are actually doing that. I've seen ads from restaurants like Dos Caminos in Times Square saying that they're going to start selling some groceries. I saw an email from Panera one day about grocery delivery. But it's really that's going to be kind of a marginal thing that we see. Part of the problem is the supply chains became very efficient. You know, in normal times, you almost never see shortages of anything in an American grocery store because the supply chains were so efficient. But they became very fine-tuned and sort of very narrow in their scope. So a big plant that makes eggs for restaurants has a really hard time redirecting those eggs for grocery use. And it has a lot to do with things like packaging and the machinery, that the way that things are packed and shipped and distributed. So it's really hard for these, you know, big food packaging companies to redirect the supplies toward grocery stores. It's hard for restaurants to redirect their supplies at the same time, too. They don't have the kind of infrastructure that's needed that would really make it possible to become a grocery store.
Right.
So at the risk of sounding alarmist here, are we going to run out of food?
I think one of the things to keep in mind is, you know, there's not a need
okay,
to
the answer
panic,
was supposed to be
you know?
No. But, you know.
Uh-huh, exactly. This is what I'm real worried about here, Millie.
I think, you know, to be, I think it's really, you know, important for people not to be panicked or to become very worried, especially in the U.S. If you're talking about a global picture, it's a little bit different if you're in a big major food importing nation. But in the U.S., you're not going to see major, major shortages of staple goods. You will probably continue to go to the grocery store and not be able to get the brand of bread that you like or the type of exact pasta. You know, we've seen a lot of shortages for baking ingredients. That's going to probably, again, you know, we'll see some inconsistent supplies there. On the meat side, there is a lot of frozen meat, but because of these shutdowns, we're now looking at, you know, just that one plant that closed in South Dakota is responsible for almost about 5% of the U.S. pork supply. So you might see some inconsistencies when it comes to fresh meat supplies.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, I feel like what we should point out here is that yes, there's enough food. Americans are not used to having to not walk into a store and see the thing that they want to buy and buy that thing all perfectly packaged and wrapped up and labeled with, you know, nutrition information and go home and cook it. And I wonder just, you know, from your perspective, what is that going to do? How are people going to respond to that? I know that's not totally your beat, but, you know, there's a lot of feelings involved in food.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, I think that's part of why people have been really attuned to this story, because especially in the U.S., it's not something people are used to at all. You know, usually you go into a grocery store and it's like an abundance of food. There's more choice than you could really handle. But right now there's going to be a situation where, no, maybe you won't get your exact favorite brand of chips when you walk into the store. And there's a lot of different choke points along the supply chain that make it much harder. You know, there's only a certain number of hours in the day that people can actually stock shelves. There's only so many trucks that are transporting things. And as we see, you know, more cases of illness at food packaging plants, among truckers, among warehouse workers, that's going to also have an impact on how quickly supplies can move from one place to another. And in terms of what that's going to do to the consumers, I think we're going to see a few different things. I mean, one of the big things that we've seen already is panic buying. And the panic buying is actually part of what's contributing to some of the shortages in the stores. You know, we're hearing reports of people buying like 40 pounds of beans. That kind of thing is not really necessary to do. You're not going to be kind of cut off from food in the U.S. But if people are hoarding it to that extent, then it's going to be really hard for the supply chain to keep up with that level of buying. Some of that will likely start to slow down. I mean, once your pantry is stocked, you're not probably going to fill every house in your home with food. So that sort of panic buying will start to slow down. But the way that people eat is going to probably start to change a little bit. I mean, and that is, you know, you mentioned that people mostly have eaten out of the home. I think more than 50% of food was consumed away from home before the virus started. And so that's causing some dislocations in terms of supplies. For example, bacon is one of the things that people mostly eat in larger quantities away from home. You're not usually throwing chopped bacon into all your dishes at home or sitting down with a bacon martini. So we've seen prices for pork bellies, you know, really fall off.
Speak for yourself, Millie.
I mean, no shame to anybody who loves, you know, munch on copious amounts of bacon, but some of those, what I kind of think of as indulgent foods, are starting to see little dips in demand. Butter is another one. People aren't throwing whole sticks of butter into their pasta dish every night like you might do at a restaurant. So there's some kind of a dislocation in terms of some buying is going up and others are going down.
Yeah. Just real quick, back to something you said earlier, and it's actually been sort of a thread through this conversation. We were talking about the pork plant in Sioux Falls. Also, you mentioned truckers. There is a huge labor force element of this story, right? Not only truckers, but packers at the warehouses, grocery workers on the front lines. I mean, there's a whole dimension of that that is operating in uncharted terrain.
That's right. And these are people that are, you know, often overlooked. They're not really in the public eye, but they're actually out there on the front lines, exposing themselves every day, you know, putting themselves in danger so that the rest of the world can keep eating. And these are jobs that a lot of times were dangerous to begin with, if you think about what it means to be working at a slaughterhouse. And they're often jobs that are filled by immigrants and migrant workers. They are sometimes low paying. They sometimes have low benefits. And so you're going to start to see, you know, these are the types of vulnerable people that are out there making sure that the rest of the world is being fed. And at the same time, you know, a lot of companies are taking measures to protect their workers. We've seen a lot of food companies talk about increasing the amount of washing that's going on, you know, spraying down break rooms, even doing things like, you know, regularly cleaning doorknobs, that kind of thing. But at the same time, these workers are usually in close proximity to each other. It's going to be hard to really keep everybody safe in a way that can also keep food production going at the same level.
And what do you think this starts to look like? Let's try to solution a little bit before we freak ourselves out. What does this look like, though, as the months go on? I mean, we're headed into harvest season. Workers may not be available or may be sick. Like, are companies trying to address this in from both the supply chain perspective and the labor perspective?
Yeah.
In terms of what companies are doing, we've seen a lot of the meat companies, for example, refigure their production chains so that they can meet some of the grocery and retail demand and less of the restaurant demand. We've also seen companies trying to hire on people. It's not just Amazon hiring more. It's also some of the meat companies and some of the other production companies on the food chain. They're actually trying to beef up their, you know, employees, excuse the pun, but they're trying to, you know, bring in more people so that they can keep the beef flowing and they can keep the food flowing. So it's really going to depend on, I think, you know, what we see in terms of if there are prolonged shutdowns at some of these plants. The South Dakota plant, for example, said that they are going to close indefinitely. The Colorado plant, on the other hand, said they're planning to reopen April 24th. They think that will give them enough time for quarantines and cleaning. And it'll just depend on, you know, whether we see more of these shutdowns start to take place. One of the things that we're keeping an eye on is what's going to happen in South America. Brazil is a huge, huge meat exporter for the world. And just in the last week, we started to see the first few positive cases come up at Brazilian meat plants. So the question is, what's going to happen there? You know, the whole food systems is really interconnected. Even a country like the U.S., which produces and exports a lot of food, we still import a lot of food too. Things like cheese from Italy, wine, produce, a lot of the produce off season is coming in from Mexico and other suppliers in South America and other places. So there's a lot of interconnection on the global scene.
Millie Munchie, she's an editor at Bloomberg's Agriculture America's team, laying out the agriculture and food supply chain for us. So we're not going to run out of food, but we might not be able to get exactly what we want. That's the upshot here?
Yeah, that's pretty much a takeaway.
Right. I'll take that one. Good. Millie, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, Millie, thanks. That was great.
Great. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Take care.
I think I feel better.
I feel better-ish, yeah. I mean, honestly, part of the reason that I really wanted to do the story is because I felt like I was so wrong. Like, when this thing first started, I was like, hey, you know what? People are going to calm down. I mean, I said it on this show. People are going to calm down. It'll probably take a week or so. Things will stabilize. They'll stop buying things. And it turns out that, like so many things, it is a tangled web
It is.
That is, you know, that is going to change the way we eat. And our producers in the Slack were saying, like, well, maybe everybody can just stop eating less meat, which honestly is probably going to happen. That whole thing where Americans have meat for every meal, probably not going to be so reasonable. We'll
The other thing that's worth a mention here, and it was in some reading, maybe it was prep for this or just something else that's been floating around there. So the thing that's been shocking to Americans is seeing empty store shelves, right? Because that's not a thing that happens in this country. The catch is that in normal times, stuff flies off shelves on a ridiculously quick basis, right? It just gets restocked. If you've ever been in a grocery store at 11 o'clock at night or 4:30 in the morning, there are people putting stuff back on the shelf so that when you get in to do your post-work shopping after work, it's all there, you know?
It's all there. Well, and the other thing actually somebody did ask us about on Twitter, and we didn't bring up with Millie, but that is the economics of how the stocking works. And we've sort of alluded to this in other episodes.
Oh, that's a good story,
but
actually.
That these stores really did. I look forward to hearing on PM tomorrow. Can't wait. Because it is. Like, they all moved to...
Right.
I'm like Hannity over here. I got an audience of what? Chyra's doll.
Oh my God.
No. Yes. We can lay bets now onto whether that makes it into the final show.
It will. Come on.
Stores did move to this very just in time, high efficiency stocking methodology to maximize their margins. And that meant they don't have stuff in the back room.
Right.
So that's a big part of this, too.
And now America goes, oh, my God, where are my oat flakes? Or whatever.
It's real interesting. One thing I will say is, like, I feel very lucky to live in California. And I think what people are finding is that they're all, like, at least in my community, we're all kind of back-channeling each other alternate shopping opportunities.
Oh,
like,
oh, that's
is
so
there, like, a lot of farmers that used to supply restaurants in the Bay Area are now basically doing pop-up CSA boxes. And a lot of wholesalers have started selling direct to consumers. And so we've been going to this, you know, fish wholesaler and buying seafood, like splitting it with three families because it's like $150 minimum. And I have like a huge thing of pork butt coming from this other wholesaler. But I think that is an opportunity. Like, I'm frankly shocked that Yelp, instead of laying off or furloughing 2,000 people, didn't try to figure out how to create some of that infrastructure for those small businesses who want to be selling out of grocery stores. Like, there's, I think, ingenuity will also flow in and get people out of just the grocery store mentality.
Here's the catch. Is it going to last? That's the catch.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know.
That's the, like, slightly scary part.
Yeah. All right. So, well, look, so that's a good pivot to the call out, right? What do you think? Is it going to last? Let us know. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. Are you going to the grocery store like every 3 days? Or are you going every 5 days? What's your experience with the food supply chain in this country? MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. We'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Oh, hello. Welcome back. I'm not going to lie. I'm still thinking about bacon martinis. Is that a thing?
I was at a restaurant. I did a thing in South Carolina, blah, blah, blah. The hosts took me out for drinks and dinner, and they had like a bacon smoked bourbon thing. drink wise.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which smelled great. I did not imbibe. I had beer, but yeah, it smelled great. Anyway, that's a little off topic.
Yum. I will say that when I read that, I somehow ended up with, because, you know, some of my grocery shopping has been a little bit random or related to like boxes and stuff. And I somehow ended up with two packages of bacon. And when I read that story about Smithfield, I put those in the freezer. I was like, I may need these to buy passage in the future.
Yes,
I don't know.
That is true.
So
it will be money. Bacon will be money.
Yep. Don't come to my.
Anyway, man, we're off the rails. Bring us back, Molly. Bring us back.
We really are. We really are. Well, okay. So my news fix today is actually directly related to that story. Because it just so happens that plant, the Smithfield plant, where all of those people are sick, is, as we mentioned a couple times, located in South Dakota, which is one of only five states that currently does not have a statewide shelter-in-place order.
Yeah.
And where the governor, up to and including yesterday, has totally resisted the efforts that would slow the spread of the virus in that state. And now, as a result, it has one of the highest per capita clusters at this one plant. And so, although some of these issues were unavoidable, not all of them were. The plants could have been taking precautions to keep people safer. See also Amazon. And this is a perfect example of how public health policy impacts not just this one state, but the entire food supply for all of the United States. That's the pee in the pool part right there.
Jesus Christ. Okay. Yep.
I'm just like, I'm feisty today. It's sunny.
Just a little bit. It is sunny. It's a gorgeous day here in Los Angeles for the first time in like 2.5 weeks. Yes, and that is why the whole thing about Western state governors and Northeastern state governors saying, you know what, we are going to take charge of this reopening and we're going to do it with science and fact and health policy, not politics. That's why that's so interesting. And just as a history poli-sci geek, the whole, Articles of Confederation versus the U.S. Constitution thing is just so interesting right now.
I mean, that's so fascinating. I agree.
Yeah,
I can't stop reading about that. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
All right, what you got?
Speaking of reading, this is it's literally labeled a long read on the Guardian's website. So hunker down and you've got some time. It's a guy by the name of Adam Tooze. He's a history professor at Columbia, and he has written what is one of the first early takes on a narrative nonfiction discussion of what the hell happened in the financial system in the early days of this crisis and how close everything came to falling apart. We will put the link on our page, but I highly recommend it. We were closer to disaster than we know. High marks for Jay Powell and the Congress of the United States and other central banks in this piece. Really interesting piece, and it's the first of many of what the heck happened and how bad could it have been. And let's be clear here.
Wow.
It might still be bad, but maybe not as bad. Yeah.
But maybe those days when Jay Powell all of a sudden came out with a bazooka and that caused everybody to panic because they were like, oh my God, you're telling us that it's way worse and you're acting too soon. You're saying perhaps not.
It was way worse. It was way worse.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
And just parenthetically, it's really interesting what generally high marks Jay Powell is getting, right? This is a guy who has been dumped on by the guy who appointed him to the job for 2 years now. And oh, look, I saved the world. Right.
Yeah. I mean, there has been a lot of like, what would Yellen do throughout his tenure?
Yeah.
I'll just say she trained him well.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Look, we should be really clear here, right? One of the reasons that Jay Powell is stepping up to this moment and making the right decisions, and it's important that we know here that he is not an economist. He's a lawyer and a private equity guy by trade, but he has been in positions of high responsibility in economic policy in this government for a long time now. And he is doing things informed by an economist, an academic economist, right? But with a sense of urgency that comes with a guy who knows the markets, you know? And I think that's important.
Totally. All right. I can't wait to geek out on this.
There you go.
I might have to download this to my Kindle. You're not kidding. It is a long read.
Yeah, no, it's extremely long. It's extremely long. So, you know, hunker down. Give it a read.
Okay.
But also, do not forget to do this. Check out our daily explainers on your smart speaker, any Echo device in your house. Make me smart. Tell them to make me smart and have a listen. Today, it's Molly, apparently, talking about the nursing shortage, which is, oh, by the way, real.
It is.
And has been in this country for a very long time, actually, nurses.
Yeah,
all right,
that is
your turn.
No joke. All right, yep.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
These days, I think we can agree it's all related.
It kind of is.
Last week, for the first time in the history of Make Me Smart, buddy, there's no slightly different. Last week, we talked about small business loans, unemployment, and we asked you to tell us how this process is going in your state. Thank you for so many of your responses because, wow. First up, we're going to hear from listener Taylor Rogers.
Hey, Kai and Molly. This is Taylor Rogers in Idaho, and my wife recently became unemployed. She was filing for the unemployment benefits, and on their web form, you have to enter the dates that you were working, the dates that you became unemployed, that sort of thing. And it's actually impossible to correctly enter your dates because the validation for the dates is in day, month, year format, but the way that they force you to select them is in month, day, year format. And that basically means for us, it's impossible to submit this form without committing fraud, which they warn you about all over the page. If you knowingly submit incorrect information, they're going to charge you $50,000. And it's really heartbreaking to see so many people messaging the Idaho Department of Labor on Facebook, on their website, and people in really desperate straits, much more desperate than us, are saying, you know, I have bills due this week and I need this unemployment right away. And they can't even submit the form.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. It's a thousand tiny cuts is what it is.
That's exactly right. Exacerbated by a lack of preparation, frankly, on the infrastructure of the financial system in the American government and getting this money out fast, right?
I have an idea.
Okay, go.
Sorry.
Yes.
It's sunny.
No, I'm sitting here.
Okay, you know how like Google and these big tech companies, I don't know if Google does it so much anymore, but they used to have this 20% time where they would let engineers specifically, like a lot of famous products came out of this 20% time. Yep. I think that the big tech companies of America should institute 20% time for their engineers to help out local governments with this kind of infrastructure. Because this is like simple WebMonkey stuff that you know, just like fix that form or whatever. But they probably don't have time and they're doing 50 million other things. And like there's a whole force of nerds who could help with this. Who can I call? Oh wait, I'm calling them now.
If only there was somebody in this conversation who had a column in a digitally focused magazine that where she could put this out there for people in Silicon Valley to read.
You're so smart. And it is in fact.
Look, I think you'd get some traction.
An idea.
You know.
Which is the name of the column. Yeah. All right, I'm doing it.
There you go.
I'm going to write that today.
All right.
Ideas.
Next one. This is about the Paycheck Protection Program loans, the $350 billion through the SBA, the Small Business Administration, that was supposed to help small companies in this economy not have to lay off a bunch of people. And this one comes from Chicago. Michael Garrison can't get a loan because, and this is the paradox of this thing, he's never needed one before. Here's what he says. I am one of three owners at Comrade Cycles, a smallish bike shop in Chicago. We employ 9 staff, and we furloughed staff with pay the same day our governor announced the stay-home order. We bank with Byline Bank, that apparently is a small local bank in Chicago, and have been told by multiple sources that we are required to apply through our existing financial institutions. Byline had a static page on their website indicating that they were accepting PPP loan applications from current loan customers and that they would be reaching out to small businesses to gather more information. On Wednesday morning, apparently, a banker reached out to him. This is Michael now with some unfortunate news. Byline was accepting loan applications only for current Small Business Administration loan customers. After those customers have been serviced, he writes, and if there is money left over, they would start moving down a list of deposit-only customers and start working on applications for them. We are effectively being penalized, he finishes, by being fiscally responsible, and the outlook for furloughed staff is uncertain. Bleak might be a better word. I hope Molly doesn't cry too much reading these PPP emails. Endeth. So there you go. Sucks. Look, it sucks. It sucks. This whole thing just sucks.
It does. It is a bad process. There does seem to be more traction on the idea of the next phase.
Yes. I'm not sure it's a bad process. I think it's an incredibly inefficient process that because of brief, semi-political divergence coming here. Because of the Trump administration's disdain for the infrastructure of government, has not been effectively supported and is able to support these payments, that, close parentheses, this has been so boogered up.
I guess the, yes. Okay. Congrats. I mean, big ups to the SBA for popping up a system like this as quickly as they did at all. I think the part that I, from my perch of like, I don't know that much, would suggest is loans, not or grants, not loans the next time around, which is the idea that's starting to gain some traction now. It's the loan part that introduced a lot of complexity that all these little banks were like,
Because banks were worried about being stuck with fraud things and holding the bag and having to do due diligence and all this stuff. No, that's a true thing. That.
Yep. All right. We're going to skip down to the make me smart question. Our favorite thing. What is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about? This one comes from Josie Fisher.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Josie in San Clemente, California. One thing that I thought I knew, but I was wrong, was I thought I knew my breaking point. Last October, my husband and I had our first child, and 1 month later, he left on a deployment. He's an active duty Marine. It was so hard in those days. My family lives across the country, and I had to handle so much on my own. Sleepless nights, fussy evenings, no one to share parenting duties, finding a daycare, going back to work, feeding myself, making time for myself, and all of it was hard. And even though I was starting to find a routine, I used to joke that I just couldn't handle anymore without breaking. Flash forward to March 2020 when COVID-19 completely upended life around the world, including the small amount of routine I had in my own life. I started working from home, and then my son's daycare closed indefinitely. I've had to figure out how to work from home while full-time solo parenting. I'm lucky I still have a job, but in order to make things work, I can only work a few hours a day. My husband's deployment is likely extending with no guarantee of a return date because he's on a ship, so communication is limited. I've had my ups and downs, but the sun keeps rising and here I am. I thought I would break, but I'm not there yet. Thank you to this whole show for such great work. I love to listen to this and Marketplace on my daily walks with my son.
You crying now, Molly Wood?
Yep.
There you go. We're going to go out on that one. Okay?
Yeah.
This stuff's real, man. This stuff is just real. That's a show for today. And we're out. We're out. We got newsletter stuff. You guys know the drill. Whatever.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. Thanks to our video producer, Ben Hethcote, who is going to leave this in, by God, and our video intern, Ethan Peretz. And thanks to our writer-producer, Erica Phillips.
Program today was engineered, I believe it's Drew Jostad on the other end of my line, but I could be wrong. Theme music was composed by Ben Dolliday and Daniel Ramirez. I'm laughing because it's being changed in real time by one Sam Anderson.
The magic
Executive
of
Director
Google
of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The Senior Vice President and General Manager is Deborah Clark.
Now you know how I felt all that time. You just could look through the window, see who it was.
That's right.
The good old days of the window.
Yeah. Someday.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.